It's time for the Picture House Podcast with your hosts, Sam and Simon. Please ensure that your mobile phone is switched off, refrain from smoking, and keep conversation to a minimum. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show!
Hello, and welcome to the Picture House Podcast. I'm Sam Clements, and I'm joined by Simon Renshaw.
Hello.
But we also have a special guest.
We do! We have with us today broadcaster extraordinaire.
Wow, honoured.
Edith Bowman. Hello, Edith. How are you?
I am so chuffed to be here. Thank you.
We're
Thank
so
you.
Chuffed to have you here. Thank you.
I love what you guys do. I love this place.
It's a great place.
It's amazing. Yeah. I kind of want to live here. Yeah. In this little round booth that we're in particularly, because it's got the most wonderful view of Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah, we should set it up. We're in the Picture House Central in central London, and we're in a sort of a little
turret.
Enclave. Yeah, it's a turret. You're right. It is a turret. Looking out over Piccadilly Circus, and there's Big Ben over there. And it's a beautiful little part of the world and a lovely place to record a podcast.
It's all your favourite landmarks. This is a coveted spot. We're in the members bar of the cinema, and a lot of members fight for this area. The word has got out that there's this little private room with a little curtain.
Plugs.
And plugs, which is important.
What do they use the plugs for? That's what I want to know. Apart from chargers.
I have seen rival podcasts recording in here.
Ban them.
But it's okay. We're taking it back.
We can reclaim it today.
I've got a little fact for you. I recorded my first ever soundtrack in this building.
Oh, really?
With Ben Wheatley.
Whereabouts?
Downstairs in the restaurant, you know, the little room that's to the side of the restaurant. So noisy because there were so many sirens going past every 10 minutes. But it was our first ever one. It wasn't the first one recorded, it was the first one that we put out.
Right.
So it's nice to be
welcome back.
Back at a scene of the crime.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Edith, we traditionally start the Picture House Podcast by looking back, reflecting on life, and more importantly, what people have seen in the cinema in the last week.
Yeah, so this is the Picture House Top 5. It's the top 5 highest grossing films at Picture House cinemas in the last week. Sam, what's at number 4?
Number 5 is Lady Macbeth, which did very well when it opened with us, and it's still in the charts. It stars Florence Pugh. It's absolutely incredible film. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Yeah.
Isn't it just so...
Wasn't what I expected at all.
Right.
It's very clever.
It's really great, I think, and such an assured debut from William Alderoyd. I'm so excited about his career and Florence's career as well.
Yeah.
Like, Christ, the two of them are really... they've really got lives ahead of them. It's just wonderful, isn't it? It's such a great piece of work.
You kind of don't want to say too much
about it
because you just have to relish in it. It's like velvet. You just want to kind of surround yourself.
It's so beautifully put together. And it, you know, it takes place in a very simplistic world, and we are shown these things in a very matter-of-fact way. But every frame is composed so beautifully, even if it's just... You know, someone sat about on a chaise longue having a bit of a nap. It's like a beautiful work of art.
It's like a painting, yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
On those sitting around scenes, because a lot of the film is about how bored the character is at times.
Well, yeah.
And the director would just ask Florence to sit on the sofa and would leave the camera rolling for sort of 10 minutes and not give her any direction to make her feel quite uncomfortable, which is important to get across, you know, days of boredom.
Yeah.
10 minutes of boredom on set probably feels like a lifetime.
That's what I loved about it as well, was the kind of contradictory pace of it in a way as well, in terms of it just... I think most people will be so quick to go, we've got to cut to this, so we have to move on. And he just let it kind of breathe. And
you really
felt that sense of, you know, that kind of... boredom, not that you're bored watching the film, but that kind of time scale thing was really cleverly done with that, I think.
It's so efficient as well, and really compact. I think, and as you say, like, beautifully paced. I don't think every single moment means something and has a purpose. There's no wasted breath in it. God, it's so great. Well done, everyone, for
number 5. Amazing, it's great.
No, it is huge. Please do go out and check it out if you haven't seen it yet. In at number 4, complete change of tone, we have Mindhorn.
Hey.
Yes.
Co-written and starring Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby, who are just wonderful.
It's wonderful. I finally saw it this week. Went to see it during the week and had such a fun time. I'd read the script for work a couple of years ago and really enjoyed it and sort of then forgotten everything about it. And it was such a thrill to see everything realised and all of its... expertise to be maximised on screen as well. It really does feel like the best film that they could have made out of what that screenplay was.
How different was the screenplay that you read to what's
really quite different.
Yeah.
It's this, I mean, I think it's basically the same with all comedy, really. Like with Alpha Papa, for example, they were just they started writing. Well, their first draft was like 18 months before they shot, and they didn't stop rewriting, like joke after joke after joke after joke, and on the day the same. So like, what you have on the script is like the bare bones and like a bit of structure, and then it's like been four different films before it's the film that you get to see, and what we see is, you know, the stuff that they thought was funniest when they got to the end of the edit, and like, so it could have been anything really. But yeah, it's fascinating. I just think Julian Barrett's done such a great job, and I'm just so glad.
I want him to do more.
I know.
You know, it's kind of, and I know Julian really well because weirdly his twins are really good friends with my oldest.
Right.
And so when he had the, because he actually shaved his head.
Right.
So you know, because underneath the wig he's got this big bald patch.
Yes.
And he actually shaved that in real life. So
you
I remember last summer at the Lido, we turned up and he comes
right.
up with this. Whoa! That is a strong look. You definitely pull it off with a Hawaiian shirt there and the flip-flops go, whoa!
Blimey. And you have to explain to everyone, don't you, then? You have to be like, it's for a thing.
Yeah, well, it's
you'll
for, see like, it. Oh, and he kind of forgot, so he kind of gets all these looks from people. I love his conviction for it. But yeah, I want him to do more, and we've seen him, you know, in Flowers, which I really enjoyed TV-wise and stuff. And I know this has been a real kind of labour of love for them as well in terms of how long it's been there and around, and I'm so glad it's out there and people are quite obviously going to see it and enjoying it.
Exactly. It's a great thing for word of mouth, isn't it? Like and it's also nice. What I really like about it is it's a cinematic comedy that isn't an adaptation of a pre-existing thing, a sitcom or a comic or something. And we need more original things. It's so refreshing.
Yeah.
We really,
When it came out, we were looking at all of the like British comedy films that had come out, and they were all like adaptations of something that pre-existed or a sequel or something. And it's really hard to get things like this made. I think Ridley Scott ended up coming in as an executive producer
on
it.
That's true.
Which is so weird to see Ridley Scott's name.
Small. He's quite a funny man, though.
Really?
I mean, I think he's got, maybe a lot of people haven't been witness to this, but I think he's got a really good sense of humour, which he tries to subdue. I mean, look at The Martian. There's so many great comedic elements in that film. And so I think that this is right up his street. And it was interesting, because I went to a screening of it, and it was like, I kind of felt like I shouldn't be there, because it was a bit like the who's who of British comedy.
Right.
Palin was there, do you know what I mean?
Wow.
Kayvon Novak was there. It was amazing. And they were all belly laughing at this thing. And, it was infectious.
What a perfect environment to see it in.
It was terrifying. And I'm sure Julian felt equally terrified. Looking out, because they introduced the film, looking out and seeing those faces.
Christ.
It's like those old TV shows, remember, like An Audience With?
Yeah.
And it would just be like famous people watching someone do stand up or Ricky Martin
terrifying.
Sing. Like weird.
Great. Let's move on to number three. What's number three this week, Sam?
So number three is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
It sure is.
And it sort of ties in nicely to you, Edith, because we listened recently to your episode
of
James Gunn.
My short compact episode with James. I think I said it's like I had 14 minutes with him.
Yeah, yeah.
I was supposed to have 12, I stretched it. I ignored the lady doing flailing arms side down.
You made it count, though. It's a great interview.
And he's kind of... I mean, he's a force of nature. He really is. Mm. And it was really interesting because, I mean, we only really scratched the surface with the whole music side, and specifically what that first Guardians film did as well. And I think, you know, it's been had a massive impact on the sales of vinyl and things like that worldwide.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
What a great power to have.
Such influence. It's astonishing, isn't it?
So good. And the fact that he didn't name the person, but an exec on the film who was like, nobody wants to hear this mix of music.
Yeah.
And he's like, I think you'll find you're wrong.
Here's one platinum record, here's another platinum record.
But he was like, you know, one of those toys that you kind of pull the back out of and let go?
Yeah.
He was a bit like that. It was kind
of
like, and off you go. And he would just, his enthusiasm for the music.
Down.
And, you know, and being kind of really respectful and thankful and grateful to things and bands and artists that have been the same to him on the way up, have given him tracks for, you know, for little money, and then
making sure
he repays the favour by including them in the soundtrack and stuff.
Very cool.
But that opening scene with Groot is just...
It's wonderful. It really is
makes
something.
Makes me so happy watching
that.
Both of the films have amazing opening scenes, and straight from the off, we're both going to be like, this isn't your traditional superhero film. We're in for something. It's a little, you know, and I think it's nice that we have that variety.
Definitely. And I mean, I don't, tell me if I'm wrong, but I get the impression that they didn't expect Guardians to be the phenomenon that it was.
Right. It's
that it was always kind of like, we're going to chuck this out. Mm, no, and it became this huge thing.
Yeah. They didn't do a UK premiere for Guardians 1, and then Guardians 2, they did the biggest UK premiere.
Tell me about it. I had to introduce them on stage. Yeah. They had like, who was it now?
Seb Fontaine
DJing with lasers at the Hammersmith Apollo. It was like, hello, London!
Massive.
Yeah. But they were, you know, most of them were all, I think, were they all there? I don't think they were all there, but most of them. I think
pretty
they
much
were.
Everyone.
Apart from Vin.
No Vin or
no
Brad.
Vin. No Vin or Brad. But, Brad's too busy being Chris Christopherson,
that's why. That's true, yes. What a thrill. No, but Kurt, that was very exciting. Mm-hmm. What a thrill. Mm.
I never get blasé about all that. Right. I still kind of completely have to kind of...
I bet.
Internally, it's kind of... It's kind of explosions inside me. Of kind of like, oh my God, it's But yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. Yeah. And my kid went. So Rudy went to see it. My oldest, who's 8.
How old are your kids? Okay.
He's 8.
Right.
A friend of his had it. It was his birthday party. They were all going to the cinema.
Yeah.
What the best thing was in the car with four of them, hearing them talk about it.
Yes.
After the film.
Yes.
About the swearing and
wow.
What they kind of, you know, levitated towards and focused on, and that was a great little kind of earwigging on that.
Of course, and to have, you know, I've spoken to various people with kids, you know, roughly the same age as your eldest, who are now having conversations with their kids about music from the 70s and the 80s and the stuff that they can introduce them to, and then wanting to like go deeper into that stuff, and like, what a thrill to keep culture alive that way.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really fun.
It's the way music should be. It should be kind of, you know, it should be ageless. It doesn't matter when you find something.
Yeah.
Mm. As long as it, you know, connects with you, you have an emotional reaction to it, that's kind of how it should work.
Yeah. It's probably like how I felt after, I think the first Tarantino film I saw was Pulp Fiction. I wasn't 8. I was a bit older, but like, then I went out and bought the CD of it, and I started listening to, you know, like 70s like rockabilly music and stuff, because it was in Reservoir Dogs and in Pulp Fiction. But I do like that power.
Yeah, Good Morning Vietnam for me.
Right, yeah, sure.
And this, you know, such a clever mechanic of kind of, you know, him being a DJ, and I had the cassette of it, of him, and the great thing that they did, bit like the Muppets ones as well, where they included the link that he did on the radio into the music and stuff.
That's such
time
a nice
to rock
thing
you from
to
the
do.
Delta to the DMZ and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's fantastic.
That's so great. I really like it when soundtracks get the extra mile for that. The soundtrack for the first Anchorman film has Will Ferrell as Ron Burgundy just doing links as if he's like hosting a radio show.
Yeah.
It's so good. And just nice to have extra stuff of him in character and like go the extra mile.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, please. More of that, please. In at number 2, something completely different.
Oh, yeah.
Occasionally in our cinemas we screen live operas and theatre and events.
Yeah.
So number 2, which beat all of the movies we've just spoke about, De Rosen Cavalier. Cavalier?
Der Rosenkavalier.
Der Rosenkavalier, from the Met Opera in New York.
Bit of fun.
Beamed out to cinemas all across the country. It's got such a huge appetite for this stuff, because it's such a rare chance to see it.
Yeah.
And we've been doing Met Opera for sort of 8 or 9 years now.
Yeah, it's a long time.
And it's just one show a week, but it can keep up with a whole week's worth of Guardians of the Galaxy.
That's amazing.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long does it last for? How long's like? I mean, in my head, I think opera lasts like a day.
No, you're all right. It probably 2.5 hours for Rosen Cavalier. Probably,
It's just never been to an opera.
Oh mate,
well, come to the cinema.
I'm gonna come.
You can bring popcorn.
That's great stuff. That's really great. I wholeheartedly recommend it.
Okay,
and we can talk about. There's an opera link to our next film, which is Alien Covenant.
Okay.
And in Alien Covenant,
yes,
we have twice used Das Rheingold, the entry of the Gods into Valhalla, which is so much fun, I think. Like, just a lovely choice for Ridley to get to do something mad and bombastic in that closing scene, which we will not divulge for listeners that haven't seen it. You've seen Covenant,
right? Oh my God, I loved it.
Me too.
I know there's a little bit of slight tension and debate between...
I think it's great. Honestly, I think it's so
much too.
Fun. It's a thrill for me, I think, more than anything else. Above, like, it's not a flawless film, but to have Fassbender's campest performance to date. I was like bent double, like screaming with delight. Mm-hmm. And I think, the first time I saw that film, I was surrounded by 500 people who didn't like revel in the high camp art that film is quite as much as I did. But I think it's there to be enjoyed, and I think that you can absolutely reappropriate it that way if you want to. And the Wagner really helps as well. It's so silly and over the top.
Yeah.
I just think it's heaven. And it's such a fascinating film in comparison to Prometheus.
So different.
It's smaller and scrappier. And Prometheus is just enormous. Like the scope and the scale and the production design. They're a fascinating contrast, I think.
I really like Catherine as well in it. I think she's
terrific.
She's fantastic.
Really, really good.
I thought the costume was great, actually.
Yeah. Me too. Danny McBride,
yeah. I mean, I think for him as well, it was definitely a step into something new for him.
Mm.
And he holds it. He's completely, he matches everyone. It's kind of
proper work
from him, which is great to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I loved it. I kind of my only little was the kind of Jedi. The Jedi look of Fassbender.
Sure.
So it's a little bit going, oh, really?
Yeah.
There could have been another sort of form of hooded figure. Yeah, it was like that.
Literally it was like costume from Assassin's Creed.
Yeah. I love the opening scene with Guy.
Oh, that was good.
It's very good.
It's really great.
It's really, really good. Again, it just really made me laugh. There's such tension in that room, but I just find Fassbender's performance as David to be so funny. There's something about it that just has me in hysterics and Guy Pearce.
In a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm laughing with it, not at it. I really do think that it's a work of high camp art.
It was like a dizzying joy, I think, when that happened, because I really didn't expect that bit of the film, especially after the horror movie sort of opening.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, they're going for it. They're going for it. Ridley's going for it.
It is. What a film.
Is he going to do more?
Apparently he's writing, or they're working on the script now. Ridley's workload is crazy. Afterwards, after the film.
80?
I think he's 79.
Looks good, isn't it?
Yeah, but he's going straight into making his next film
right
now, which is starring Kevin Spacey, which is about the kidnapping of Getty Jr. And then after that, he's going, and he wants that out in time for the awards season, so January, February time.
Makes sense.
Fine. And then after that, he's doing Cartel, which is a gangster film starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
Of course.
And then after that, he's hoping to do Alien Covenant 2 or whatever it will be called.
Box office.
No rest whatsoever. Like, we see this with directors like Woody Allen, who do very small films once a year.
Yeah.
Ridley does huge tentpole movies several times a year.
Yeah.
Like, an incredible.
And then also
pace.
Throws his weight to things like Mindhorn.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's
incredible.
Yeah,
it's
setup.
Now, I know that you're both such huge fans of Alien Covenant, so I asked our friends at Fox to send some merchandise. Because, you've seen the film three times in the space of a week.
I feel lame for it.
Love it.
I got a hat, which I think Edith would be great.
Look at this.
It's a good t-shirt for you.
Thank you very much.
I was actually going to buy one of these hats today.
Those will come in handy when you're in deep space.
This t-shirt has a tag on it that just says, "See the movie."
It's direct marketing.
See the movie.
We've unwrapped some exclusive Alien Covenant merchandise.
Oh my god, that's legitimately beautiful.
Look at that.
It's a Covenant Weyland Yutani badge. That's
going straight on my Ramones t-shirt now.
Oh, you're so kind.
Thanks, Sam. I was not expecting gifts. Really lame that I haven't brought you in.
No one leaves empty-handed here.
Look at these.
Genuinely feels like Christmas.
Absolutely beautiful.
I have to say, as a studio, Fox generally are very good at producing merchandise.
Yeah, right? Clearly.
Too much money.
Look at these.
Everyone can have a badge. Even me, who was lukewarm on the film. I will support the badge.
Good bit of merch. Love it.
I can be bought.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is the best top five we've
ever... I'm taking the hat. Should probably take the label off it, though. But there you go.
The alien hat is whoever briefed in the hat design was like, now we need to make it look like it's been in the movie. It's been weathered. It looked like an alien has bitten the cat.
Many picture houses is everything you could need.
friendly ushers and organic snacks. It's a very fine place indeed. A range of films is remarkable, and every genre makes the list. And you can take your drinks into the film if you really want to get comfortable.
Welcome, Edith.
Thanks.
Again.
Yeah.
Hi.
You are, I think, like such a big fan of movie soundtracks.
Yeah, and it's kind of... I'm learning about it still as well. You know, I'm not any kind of aficionado on, you know, score music or anything like that. I didn't study it or... But I just more and more kind of see and hear the kind of the power of it and the necessity of it. Also the necessity of not having too much and how, you know, each film has a pulse and a requirement and a tone and a picture to paint, which the music is so important and intrinsic to that. And I just love talking to filmmakers about it. And
yeah.
I feel as well with the podcast, we're just at the start of where we can go with it. We had Stephen Woolley on a show.
Yeah.
And, I mean, God, we only scratched the surface in terms of his work and as a producer in terms of what he's brought, you know, Bowie and all Sade and all that kind
of
stuff. And it was interesting because, you know, you just assume that the director is the person who goes, we'll have that, and tells the composer what he wants and stuff. But each film and situation is different.
Mm.
And Stephen is an example of someone who's fully involved as the producer side of things and the music and helping to kind of manifest that and things. So, yeah, I'm in my element.
Yeah.
If I could do one thing for the rest of my life, it would be making the podcast.
Yeah, it's so great.
It.
And it's such a thrill. You get such a high quality of guests. I was listening to the Gore Verbinski one just recently, a man whose work I love and has such a key influence on the music in his films. And not just with Zimmer, with so many other composers as well. Yeah, and what a thrill to be able to jump in on their entire life's work and
in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's quite nice because Ben Wheatley was our first show and
we've
done a second one with Ben, and that's what's quite nice is that we can go back because there's no way we can take everything off with everyone, and there's also, you know, there's new material coming out, but also there's things that they might pick up on that we can refer to, like I did Guy Ritchie last week for a future episode. And you know, and whether you're a Guy Ritchie fan or not and you liked King Arthur or not, I think it's almost irrelevant because the way that he approaches music is really interesting. And he's just a great storyteller in how he relates all that, and he's got some very funny stories about Hans Zimmer.
I bet.
Yeah,
how exciting.
Hansy.
Right. Excellent. God, I can't wait to hear it. When do we get that? In a couple of weeks?
That is going
to
be, I think that's next Friday, actually.
Great.
So, yeah. So we got John Madden this week.
Yeah.
Who's got a wonderful collection of stories and experiences of working with composers, and he very much is someone who knows his stuff, so he knows that world. He's not just someone who, you know, and a lot of the directors as well will say that, you know, I can't talk in musical terms, I can only talk in emotions or feelings, so that's the way that I communicate with them. But with John, he knows much more kind of on their level of how to talk to his composers. And he's really honest as well about why he's gone with, you know, he had quite a long relationship with Thomas Newman with the Marigold Hotels films and stuff, and then Max Richter on this one.
Yeah.
And he's very honest in the fact that to get certain tax breaks, we had to have a certain amount of British or non-British people working, so we had to go with a British composer or a non-British composer, you know. And so it's interesting to know that has to form the decision-making process for them as well, rather than them going, he's the best man for the job.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a really healthy thing as well because it forces them to work with other people, which then I think can bring a different texture to their work.
Yeah.
And I think Max in particular with Miss Sloan, what he's done with that score, it's so simplistic and minimalist, but it's so striking and perfect, I think, as well.
It really leaves an impression.
Mm.
It's what
he always
does best.
I think, yeah.
He's so clever.
Yeah, he's so clever.
Mm.
But I like hearing the stories about their worlds as well. I mean, you know, we want to go down the route of speaking to them all, and hopefully we're going to get Max in the next couple of weeks.
Great.
Fingers crossed. And Lauren Balfe as well, we're going
to
speak to. It was quite nice. I did an event a couple of weeks ago with Lenny Bramison, Ed Gwynne, and Stephen Rennicks.
Right.
So three of them together. It's for a kind of Q&A thing.
Yeah.
And that was a really lovely setup because they all kind of talked about each other, but they all talked to each other and brought up lots of different stories. And that's kind of what's nice as well, is the directors regaling their experiences and their thoughts on the composers and telling stories about, not telling stories so to speak, but, you know, kind of painting a picture of what it's like in their world.
Yeah, and that anecdotal stuff is always such heaven. I remember, as I said, I was just listening to the Gull one the other day, and him talking about his relationship with Hans, and him saying that he won't read the script, he'll say sit me down and tell me what the story is, and he'll get so much more than that than he would from the blueprint of a screenplay.
Well, that's exactly what Nolan did as well for Interstellar,
right? Yeah,
was that he sent Hans a one-page synopsis of the film and said, have you got time to read this? Can I get a day of your time? I'm going to send you something, read it and send me something back by the end of the day that, you know, you see as being part of the soundscape for it. And it was that whole kind of organ kind of backbone to the soundtrack to the film. And so he sent that back, and Christopher Nolan said that was the framework to then what became the screenplay in the film in itself.
Yeah, and yes, that symbiotic relationship, that's so interesting how it like two creative minds and more can like feed each other that way.
Well, James Gunn said, you know, when they're working on the music, that they work on the score before they start filming, so that he can play the score on set to kind of get the atmosphere in everybody's minds, be the cast, be it, you know, the gaffer, whatever.
That's a really great thing.
Yeah.
What a thrill.
Yeah.
So I'm intrigued with the podcast, because there isn't, like, there's loads of movie podcasts out there with which we are contributing with this.
Certainly.
But there's not many who, like, focus on just one element of movie making, and I think you found a really great space to sort of have a, you know, allow someone to maybe talk about something they don't get to talk about very often.
That's what most of them say at the end of it.
Sure.
Jordan Voight Roberts, I loved him.
Yeah.
He was the most amazing beard, which went down to his belly button, pretty much.
Incredible.
He was amazing, but he was like, and it's what can be slightly annoying sometimes is when you go to do it, they've not been told in advance, and so it can be quite it's a bit depending on, you know, how many films they've done and how old they are and all that kind of thing. There's a lot of work there. And so sometimes it'd be so beneficial if they were told in advance they could at least delve into the memory bank, do you know what I mean? To kind of go, oh yeah, no, that was that one I worked with, or, oh, I remember that. Just so they've got it in their brain.
It's a bit of a gear shift change for them.
Well, from kind of being in that, you know, they're normally doing it on a junket day and they're kind of being asked the same question for the past 5 hours or whatever. So but then once they get into the flow of it, I mean, more times than not, touch wood, I won't bang the table, they kind of come away going, that was great, that was really good.
Yeah.
I had a lovely experience with the director, Justin Carzo from Assassin's Creed. And so we went in and started doing the interview, and we were chatting away and did it. And then I was like, listen, thank you so much. I was like, you know, we'll go away and we'll weave the music. And he was like, oh, I know, I really enjoyed your Derek C. in France episode. And I was like, what?
Incredible.
That blew my little Scottish mind.
That's a compliment.
I was like, that far. that was amazing.
So nice.
But yeah, so I mean, I love it. I just it's an open book, really, because every chat's so unique to that person. Every episode's different. Sometimes it will be very music geeky, then other times there might hardly be any chat about music because it takes us off somewhere else, and I never really plan the conversation. I have my kind of points and my notes and stuff like that, but I want it to feel like a conversation and it to lead where they want to. And some of them are easier than others. Warren Beatty was quite hard,
right?
But that's because he was amazing, and it was, you know, kind of just sat there going, oh my god, it's Warren Beatty. And he's got an incredible loyalty to people that he's worked with, and that he doesn't want to tell stories about people because he feels like he's being disloyal to them. And he feels even by just telling a nice story about someone is almost a way of kind of being disloyal. But because as soon as we hit stop on the microphones, there's a couple of stories that he told me that were amazing. But you know, he was great. He talked about, you know, with Shampoo in particular, and Paul Simon having a really difficult conversation where Paul Simon came with his collection of songs and he had to say it wasn't good enough.
Wow.
And it's kind of like, whoa,
Blimey.
Yeah.
Who's next on the? Who, have you got anyone who you know, on the list who is like you know top three all time? If there's any chance,
John Williams. Yeah. I mean, I would fly to the other side of the world. Speaking to people who have been involved in that Star Wars world, like speaking to Gareth, who I adore. I think he's a wonderful person and a really exciting filmmaker.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, in terms of him and that experience of working on that film, but trying to bring in. You know, his own influence into that as well. And similarly with Jurassic, the new Jurassic Park film, and J.B. Ohnoh bringing in Johan Johansson.
Yeah.
And you know, so having that framework of that iconic thing that's there, but also weaving in your take on it, I guess, as well. But yeah, he's definitely top of the list.
Of course.
I mean, Scorsese is another one that I would love to chat to.
Yeah.
Sofia Coppola.
Yes.
Who it looks like it's going to happen.
Great.
So
amazing. What fun.
Yeah, she's in Cannes at the minute and her lovely publicist who's got the most amazing name, she's called Bumble.
Wow.
And so she was, we were been in contact about it and she's like, are you going to Cannes? I'm like, that. Oh no. Yeah. But, but because there's not enough women on it. We can't, it's hard.
Sure. It's a very male-dominated world.
It's so hard, and I really try.
Yeah.
And we've got Alice Lowe coming up, talking
about
revenge, which is great. We've had Thea Sherrick, which was nice because she, a real mix of theatre, TV and film. Andrew Arnold.
Yes, of course, yeah.
But then I'd really like Misha Levy, I really want to speak to. I think she'd be great.
Yeah.
But also screenwriters and female producers. I wanted Nyla Park, I'd love to. I think she'd be great to speak to, obviously, with her. Long relationship with Edgar and all that as well.
Yeah.
And Edgar, we've got Edgar Part 2 coming up,
great.
Which is a Baby Driver special.
Yes.
I mean, we need about 5 hours for that. It's phenomenal.
How many tracks are on the soundtrack?
38 or something, I think.
38.
Mm.
Jesus Christ.
It's so clever. It's so clever.
God, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I am very excited to watch that film.
Yeah.
We made a mistake the other day. I found out, but I didn't tell you because we'd be too upset.
Oh, God,
we went to watch Baywatch the other night, but just before I left, there was a screening of Baby Driver we could have gone
to. Oh, my God, I feel sick for you.
But we were committed to Baywatch, and it was surprisingly hard to get into Baywatch.
Can you give me a noise that describes Baywatch?
Just like, a real death rattle. It's not 21 Jump Street.
Okay. No, we all wanted that. It doesn't quite... Even with The Rock, who is a great presence on screen.
Sure.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Oh! Yes! Let's talk about Moana.
I have the vinyl here.
Oh, you come so well prepared to a podcast recording, Edith. You have bought four vinyls of you.
I'm not going to pretend that it was planned. I came from doing my radio show, and so I brought these back because I brought them in the other day because we had a vinyl hour on the show, and I was like, I've got to take these home, otherwise they'll get lost.
Did you play anything from Moana on the show?
Yes, of course I did.
I
played You Welcome.
Excellent.
It's so, the soundtrack to this film is just magical.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's Mark Mancina's best work, and I think it's, as I was saying earlier, I think it's the best stuff of 2017 so far.
It's so good. We listen to it all the time, and the kids, you know, they're like, the idea of them listening to an album, and they always say, can you put it on from the start?
Yes.
That's so nice.
I guess maybe because they've watched the film so much, they know the flow of it.
Sure.
Which is great. So I've got that one. I've got La La Land.
Excellent.
Again.
It's a beautiful.
Where did you stand on La La Land?
Very keen.
I
both
loved
of us.
It, yes.
Yeah,
and
too.
A wonderful soundtrack. I think I've got the same
it's
record.
Beautiful.
It's so earwormy.
Yeah, totally.
You can't help
such
but
a clever man.
I loved about it as well was that, you know that scene in the film where they're both sat at the piano and they reprise City of Stars?
Yeah.
And there's the imperfections and the giggles, and they kept that as the take,
beautiful.
And they kept that as the take on the.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's so nice to have that.
So good.
Yeah.
But then I've got Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, which isn't a soundtrack, but he's obviously a man who's appeared on many a soundtrack.
Many soundtracks.
Yes.
A classic.
Yeah.
A total
very
classic.
Important figure.
I'm glad you loved Moana.
It's the best.
Why have not enough people seen it? It's
because
just like, is that on DVD?
People don't know what's good for
it
them.
Is.
Yes, it is.
I've rewatched it recently on Blu-ray, and I've listened to the soundtrack almost daily since seeing the film for the first time in December. And when we put the film on, and I hadn't seen the film since, I only seen it once in the cinema, and when we put the film on at home, I was watching it with my wife, and we were both just like, it's smiling so hard, our faces hurt, because we knew the song so well.
Yeah.
And like Mark Mancina's cues, and all the lyrics, and it was like irrelevant that the film was on. It was just like a chance for us to sit and just do nothing but listen to the music.
Yeah.
And we're like, it's this bit. It's so exciting. And I haven't really felt that about a film for so long.
No.
A wonderful, wonderful soundtrack.
Joyous.
A wonderful movie.
On the rare occasions that I go for a run, I'll run up Parliament Hill, and when I get to the top, I'm like that, I am the one.
The first time I saw the film, so obviously we have I'm Moana is a key song that we get like 25 minutes into the film, and I was watching it with my girlfriend and her nephew, who is like 6 years old, and there was a moment where he got quite scared, so we had to leave the cinema, and then as soon as we left the cinema, he pointed back at the cinema and went back in, caught the second half of You're Welcome. I was like, it's fine, we can still understand what's happening. So we had I Am Moana, that incredible moment, first time off, and then we get the reprise at the end, and she sings I Am Moana again. And I had misheard what was happening at that point, and I became convinced that she sings I Am a Woman. And like it was like...
Oh, that's interesting, because it's a good...
And my girlfriend wasn't paying attention, and she was whispering to me, I was like, you don't know what's just happened. This is a very important moment in cinema. First off, she sang I Am Moana, and now she's singing I Am a Woman, and it's the most beautiful thing, the most important thing that's ever happened in a Disney film. You're not giving it the respect it deserves. And then I listened to the soundtrack, and I was like, nope, she's just sang Moana again. Just singing I Am Moana. Both times, it's a reprise. It's a straight reprise.
I love that.
That's such a good film.
Do you think they'll do more?
I really hope so. It feels ripe for it, right? I mean, like, there's so many things that you can do with that world. Even if Moana isn't the protagonist, I think you can do 100,000 things.
Well, they've definitely invested in it. We were in the States at Christmas, and we went to Disney.
Mm.
And they've always had that kind of Polynesian village kind of site element to... Right. Disney World, I remember going there as a kid, and so obviously they're incorporating this into that, and Moana was very obvious, and there was, you know, Moana characters going around and stuff, so I'm like, fingers crossed, yeah.
That would be a total delight.
Yeah. Also, for people that as big a Moana fans as us, not to too hard plug the work of rival cinema chains, but the Prince Charles in Leicester Square, for those in London, did a Moana sing-along. A couple of weeks ago.
Oh, man.
That sold out so well, they're doing another one.
Yes, it's on sale.
It is on sale.
It's June, I think.
Do you dress up?
I don't know. I don't know.
You know,
if
like the Sound of Music
that.
Ones, it's kind of sing along with Sound of Music, and everyone goes as nuns.
Sure.
I think we should dress up.
How much goes the chicken?
What a heavenly film. Well, listeners, if you haven't seen Moana yet, maybe urge you to watch Moana.
A belated review of Moana, but a huge recommendation. It's out now on DVD, and you have to. I've been buying Moana on like gift, you know, on like iTunes and other things. You can probably like gift people a purchase.
Right. Yeah.
For the last few birthdays I've had, I've just emailed them like a voucher to download Moana.
That's a great present.
So, like, I know you didn't see this. You should see this.
Yeah. That's a very good idea.
That's a great idea. Smart.
Right, well, we should very quickly wrap up with a look at some of the new films coming out this week.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
One of which I think is very close to your heart, Simon.
Yes, very much so.
Pirates of the Caribbean film. The Caribbean. What is it called in the UK? There seems to be lots of titles.
It's called Salazar's Revenge. And
Salazar's Revenge.
Exactly. That's the problem. I'm never particularly keen on franchises using the names of characters that haven't been introduced yet to get people into the cinema. You're like, okay, cool. Who's that guy? Revenge? All right, sure, fine. It's called Dead Men Tell No Tales in the US and Salazar's Revenge everywhere else. Disney were concerned that there would be, when it comes to ancillary, not at the cinema, there'd be confusion between the second film, Dead Man's Chest, and the fifth film, Dead Men Tell No Tales. So they changed it to Salazar's Revenge everywhere else, but in the US it's still Dead Men Tell No Tales because Jerry said, no, that's the title of the film. And it's a pretty decent bit of work. Full disclosure, I'm a pirate. No, I am very invested in the franchise. I wrote my dissertation at university on the first
did
three
you?
Films. I did.
Wow.
I really, really, really love them. So I had had sort of mixed feelings getting into this. The fourth film is a real disaster, and like really feels like gore isn't around anymore, and that made me quite sad. And I'm very pleased to report that this is certainly a step up. We've got the directors of Kon-Tiki and the writer of Catch Me If You Can. And it's a brand new team, apart from Jerry and Disney. And I think a lot of the complaints about that franchise usually come down to its convoluted and overcomplicated plotting, which I'm very keen on, but I understand that as like popcorn fare, it can be quite difficult, especially when the film is like 168 minutes long. This is the shortest Pirates of the Caribbean film. It also has a very simple plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a treasure hunt. Everyone is trying to get the Trident of Poseidon to rule the seas, and that's it. And it's good fun. There are great set pieces again. Remember in the first three when like Jack becomes basically like a Looney Tunes character and like jumping around to like a building,
swinging
or like
from rocks
exactly.
and all that.
So they've remembered that that's fun because we just get none of that in on Stranger Tides, the fourth installment. So we get loads of that. We open with that, we finish with that, and we have a few great set pieces in between. It's a hoot. The score is written by Jeff Zanelli, who is one of the many Zimmer proteges, and it's a decent piece of work. I think he has to, I mean, he's bound to use the huge bank of themes that Zimmer and Klaus Badelt built up over films 1 to 4. And I mean, there's some cutting and pasting. and it's odd because Zimmer's work, especially in 2 and 3, is very, it's like almost Wagnerian. He's like, there's a theme for absolutely everything. And
it's as classical as he gets, isn't it, in terms of kind of, you know, traditional.
It's unbelievable. It's like no other work, as far as I'm concerned, in the last 10 or 15 years. Because it's put together so precisely. There are heaps of characters, everyone with their own theme, and then adding on top of that, like, you know, various like plotting themes or romance themes or MacGuffin themes or whatever. So to hear those themes, I mean, like, this isn't going to mean anything to anyone apart from nerds, but like to hear those themes reappropriated for different characters and different moments in the fifth film is like a bit of a shame, but
it's a bit lazy.
Fine. Yeah, sure. Mm. So there's hardly any new music, but the stuff that Jeff's done is pretty decent, and it's fun. Javier Bardem as a big scene chewing villain who's a zombie pirate, sure. And I think it's the best that Jeffrey Rush has been in any of them. I think he's having so much fun, and proper plot stuff for him as well. It's a hoot.
I had a
much better time than I was anticipating. I'd recommend it. It's a hearty piece of entertainment.
Cool.
Solid recommendation. Also out this week is The Red Turtle, and we have an interview with Michael Dudok DeWitt, Oscar-winning animator, on a mini episode, so do check that out. But it's a wonderful film, unlike anything I've really seen. A completely dialogue-free animation about a castaway on an island.
Oh, wow.
His only companion is a turtle, also completely silent. It's a bit like Moana, but completely different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Similar location.
Shades
and
of Moana. There's stuff in there. It's so beautiful.
It's co-produced by Studio Ghibli, and it's got that beauty, but it's also a British French co-production as well, so it's sort of got hints of Ghibli but is its own thing, which is really nice. And it's the director's first feature film. He primarily works in shorts, but was approached by Ghibli to make a feature, and he was like, we've never thought about making a feature. Okay. But we had a really great chat with him, so do check that out.
I'll listen to that.
And the last half of this podcast has been very water themed, very seafaring.
That's true. Seafaring stuff. I think that's, well, I mean, writing music for the screen, seafaring stuff really lends itself to that. There's so much you can do with shanties and.
In the Guy Ritchie episode that's coming up and soundtracking, he sings an Irish.
Lovely.
Wow.
Little sea chanty that was not planned.
Delightful.
What was your reaction when that happened?
Kind of, I think I was slightly aghast. I mean. But he was a lot of fun.
Great.
That's brilliant.
So
we've got Guy Ritchie's up next on soundtrack.
Yeah, John Madden this week, and then Guy Ritchie the following week. I'll tell you who else we've got is David, oh my God, now I forgot his name, Derek, who's done War Machine.
Yes.
David Michaud.
Yes.
Great.
What a nice man he is. I love Animal Kingdom and all that. And
great piece of work.
Fantastic. So, yeah, so that's the kind of next 3 weeks.
Great.
Wow, you're so far ahead.
Well, it's just when they're around.
Sure.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, you've got to get
And
them.
David was great because he's worked with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis on War Machine, so that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And a Netflix thing, so, you know, it's quite an interesting to kind of see if there's a different approach to it, if it's that rather than big screen cinema.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Fascinating.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you so much
for
talking to us
today. Thanks for having
me, guys.
Real pleasure.
Pleasure, thanks for coming.
We'll put a link up to your podcast in the show notes for this. But can't recommend soundtracking enough, especially if you know, you're a big music fan. I just want you to get the crew from Moana on. Can you please do that? Can you make that happen?
I'm hoping that Lynn's going to be across for when Hamilton starts.
Yeah, a few months.
So the request's gone in.
Great.
But yeah, I mean, I would love to get out. I'm going to go and get some tickets for this.
away.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Thank you, listeners,
guys,
for listening. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks. Cheers, guys.
Thanks very much.
You have been listening to the Picture House podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening and see you next week.